up this morning with the sundown shining in.
Where's the money, Lebowski? Where's the f***ing money, head?
It's down there somewhere. Let me take another look.
I found my mind in a brown paper bag, but then...
106 miles to Chicago. We got a full tank of gas, half a pack of cigarettes. It's dark, and we're wearing sunglasses.
Hit it.
I tripped on a cloud and fell 8 miles high. I tore my mind on a jagged sky.
Okay, you know, you guys aren't privy to all the new so, that's what you pay me for.
I just dropped in to see what condition my condition was in.
Illinois Nazis. I hate Illinois Nazis.
Yeah, let's cut to the chase, okay? What are you guys selling?
I lost you $60,000. There is no one who wants to make that money back for you more than I do.
There's just one thing, dude.
What's that?
You have to use so many cuss words.
What the f*** are you talking about?
Don't worry, nobody's listening anyway.
I woke up this morning with the sundown.
Well, welcome back to Stacks and Jacks. I'm Tomo. Ricky on the board. SP Futures up 15. NASDAQ Futures up 40 as the party appears ready to continue. Oil down 330. And we now are appreciably higher than we were before the war started. But don't worry, every day Trump comes out and says the war is going to be ending soon and we go higher. But that's really not the reason. As the Federal Reserve balance sheet came out yesterday, and although not as egregious as last week, we're now $95 billion into the system since the war started. Put a big multiplier effect on that, throw it into the market where you can borrow 50%, and guess what? The market's up. So anybody who thinks this has anything to do with the war, well, I guess it doesn't matter. It's going up. People are making money, so everybody's happy. So we have Professor Kevin.
Yeah, you do. Good morning.
How are you, buddy? If you were at the Sox game last night, I could have spotted you.
Yeah, you could have spotted me, but I wasn't at the Sox game. I was teaching class till 9 o'clock Eastern.
Well, good for you. Kevin, is there a huge difference, I mean, there surely was at the University of Chicago, between the students during the day and the students at night?
Our students profile a lot anyway. That, you know, most of them, if you take the three big things in their lives, you're talking about families, work, and school. And our students profile such that they generally have 2 out of 3, and many have 3 out of 3. So, you know, when people have full-time jobs, they tend to take more evening classes. But we get students who'll take evening classes anyway. It just depends. And it also depends, you know, we have two locations where I work. I work in South Bend and in Elkhart. And our Elkhart County location is almost all, for our disciplines, is almost all in the evening. It's like 3/4 of the people are evenings, and about 3/4 of them are part-time students. Full-time students are more likely to go during the day. And part-time students are more likely to go during the evening.
Do you, is there a difference in class time?
What do you mean by that? What do you mean class
time?
Well,
when you went on campus, this is years and years ago, this is when I was in grad school. If you went on campus, you had two, 75-minute classes a week, and if you went at night, you had one 150-minute class. And I took a couple at night. The difference was absolutely dramatic, especially if you worked all day.
Well, the one I'm teaching now meets twice a week, and it meets for 2 hours and 45 minutes.
Wow, that's serious stuff.
Yeah, it is, and it's a lot to fill up. I can teach the same class once a week as a hybrid. That just means that they have more work to do independently.
All right. I mean, so, I noticed. Well, I mean,
If I teach that same one on Saturday mornings, no, we don't meet twice a week. Then we only meet once a week, and I teach it as a hybrid.
Well, the difference in performance between the people who, well, I'm going to make up, not make, I'll take an educated guess at the difference in profile. The people who are going during the day were full-time people who just got out of college. And I'd say most of them did not have a job, and maybe a few of them had a family, I don't know, but I would doubt it. And then the people at night, Not only was it twice as long, the place wasn't exactly air-conditioned, although it was only a couple months of the year, and you'd worked all day, and you're supposed to absorb twice as much, and then you had to go home to a family. I don't think anybody, well, they marked the two classes together, and on like a curve. Ugh. Ugh. I don't think, and you know, I wasn't the brightest bulb.
Yeah, that wouldn't make, you know, I'd have a hard time justifying the statistical basis for that.
Yeah, I guess we could have taken it at night, the full-time students, but nobody did. I don't think anybody downtown ever got a higher grade at any test than any than a few of the people that were in the classes I was in. Doesn't mean they didn't pass. I mean, you know, they did okay, but it was just unfair.
This kind of stuff depends on, there's a lot of circumstances that go in. As a community college, it depends on the discipline. So a lot of my IT students, they don't intend to even get an associate's degree. Some of them will come back. Let me stratify a little bit here. So if you're just trying to skill up, so you're already working, you're an adult, you've been in the workforce for a while, and you want to skill up, and you might come back and you might pursue a credential in IT support or IT networking or something like that. You're just here to get a certificate, to complete a program, to earn some industry certifications so that you're more employable than you were before. That's one group. There's another group that is looking to get a four-year degree, and they're taking the first 2 years from us, and those students are more likely to be majoring in something like computer science, data analytics perhaps, or even informatics. So they're looking to complete their associate's degree and then move on to either IU South Bend or IU in Bloomington or Purdue or someplace like that. That's a different group. And then you get some who kind of on ramp and off ramp. We see that a lot in my supply chain students, where they'll come on and they're just looking to get some industry certifications and maybe earn the 6-course certificate from us. Then they go back and now they're promotable. They may be promoted to a supervisor, manager. Maybe get a job, an office job, and get off the production line, getting a job in purchasing or something like that. But then when they want to move up, they start seeing themselves as a plant manager, they're going to come back to us, they're going to finish up the associate's degree, get all those general education programs, improve their writing skills, communication skills, all those kinds of things, and then perhaps even from there move on and get a bachelor's degree. And, you know, you're going to need a bachelor's degree if you envision yourself being VP of operations or something like that. So that's another track that you have. And of course, then we get the students fresh out of high school who are just getting their first 2 years in, and they're fully intending to go and get a bachelor's degree. So it just sort of depends. We also, and this is our local profile. We have a lot of students who are, first generation college students. Period. You know, nobody in their family has ever been to college, and so they're getting a jump start. Part of our academic profile is that a very high percentage of our students are, to use the academic term, they're Pell eligible, which means if they're eligible for Pell grants, then their family income is either below the official poverty
line. Now, these are people that already, it's their family, though, not the family they're part of, or either one.
Oh, it depends on it depends on age and circumstances and so on. So if you're coming right out of high school, your family may not meet the income hurdles, and you're eligible for Pell grants, and that's a whole family thing. But if you're also somebody who has been in the workforce for a while, but you haven't been working in high profile jobs, maybe you've been working at fast food joints and something like that, and you might live on your own, but you're barely getting by, and you're trying to upskill, then that's a whole different profile.
Do you have anybody that, I'll use the term, is backs up? When I say that, my first job...
Well, I back up all the time, but that's another issue.
My first job was with Allied Van Lines, right? And I was a, well, I don't know what I was over there. I was kind of a consultant, and I did some of their high-end work, and but I also went out and helped some of their individual places, which is what I wanted to do. But I already had my MBA, but there was an outfit that's still around, I think, although I think they're mostly all online, called the American Management Association. Remember hear of those guys?
Yeah.
Well, because they had a big class building right in the parking lot. What was the name of the hotel up on the Kennedy? That was the first one that had the big dome over the pool. Was that a Sheraton? Whatever that place was. They were like attached to that Sheraton. And every week they'd give, you know, 5 or 6 classes, maybe even 10 classes. And I think the guys at Allied had me go to, what the hell did I take? I took something like, you know, logistics of trucking, or, you know, some kind of marketing for those kinds of firms, whatever it was. And, you know, I got a couple of certificates. I don't know what the hell they are, but it was interesting. You know, I learned stuff there that I didn't learn in undergrad or graduate. Plus, Kevin, I tell you what, a lot of people must have loved to go, because it was right attached to the place. Everybody stayed in a hotel. The bar was jammed every night. Let's say some marriages were started there. Should we everyone to go? I mean,
possibly end it.
No, yeah. So, maybe. Well, one starts, one ends, I guess. But I mean, I guess my question is, if you know, if all of a sudden we were trying to really up, right now we use all our clearing firms software and everything. The two clearing firms we have, which is fine because they got great stuff. But what if all of a sudden we wanted to branch out and do like some, we're an NASD member, we could upgrade our membership and become a market maker overnight in stocks. Well, if we did that, we'd want to have a lot of our own kind of software. Would we, if we hired some people even had IT backgrounds, would we send one of those guys who may already have a graduate degree in something else to one of your classes to learn something specific for what we're trying to do now?
A couple of options there. So one is, yeah, in fact, I just worked with somebody to get started this semester, who works for one of the local banks, and has a help desk job, but wanted to get some certifications. So we got him in the certification prep course, and he's working through that. So yeah, we get people who do that, but we also we have a separate group. And in fact, next we'll talk about this too. Next Friday, I'm actually going to teach a leadership seminar for them, and that's our the group. We call the group Career Link, I'm going to have some clients, some business clients, who are just giving me their people for a day to go through. Just to go through some fundamentals and some exercises and so on, to do some leadership development. It's not for credit. They're paying us to do it, but it's just a separate a separate entity type of class like you're describing, and we do that for all kinds of things. We have a company that we're we have a group of people doing industrial sewing for them because it's the RV industry, and they make furniture. So we have a whole group that's teaching how to do industrial sewing.
Really?
You get all kinds of
where the
stuff.
Hell do you, where do you find an instructor for that?
That was not my problem. It's not part of my curriculum. But definitely, when you're community college, at least ours, it's to serve the needs of the state of Indiana, and we're pretty good with that mission about saying what does the state need, what does the local area need, what does the statewide need, what are they, what industries are they trying to support, how do we get in there and support them. And some of that is with degree seeking or credential seeking programs, and some of that is for stuff that is not, it's not for any college credit, but it's definitely, and we can do certificates. I've taught not for credit and quality management before and gotten people some nationally recognized certifications along the way, so we can do that.
Well, when you say credit, could be credit like the counselor at Notre Dame gave me. I'll give you credit, good job.
Yeah, well, you can do that, and you have the ability to crosswalk some of that stuff eventually, and what that means is, hey, I took your whole, you know, I took your whole LEAP class and got a LEAN certification. I got a yellow belt, which is a real basic level LEAN certification. And I got that not for credit. How can I turn it into college credit? Well, first of all, you have to pay us, but you have to pay us something for it. But certain credentials we have set up as automatically will translate to college credit for it with that. You know, you have to do the application process, and we have other stuff where you might have to build a portfolio, and indicate that you can, you know, you're demonstrating the prior learning, and you go ahead and do it that way.
What kind of leads me into it. I don't want to go into it too far, but what exactly are, I mean, somebody goes on, gets an associate's degree, and it melts into a four-year degree, like I said, some of your people do, or maybe even the majority of them do, it kind of dovetails with a lot of schools wanting you to take a lot of your majors and maybe 2 years at that school to get a degree from there. How does that dovetail to four schools and 4 years for basketball and football players?
Yeah, it doesn't pertain to me at all.
I know, but I'm saying you guys have set it up where it does work. How does going a year at every different place work, I guess, is my question. Not that you guys do it. I'm saying you do it this way for a reason, because it does work.
It's transfer credits. What credits will they accept? So, for instance, we as a Indiana public school, we have agreements with what our transfer programs look like. So we're pretty specific about, you know, what's in the computer science program, as an example, that so that all of those credits, so 60 credits, can transfer across to Indiana public school and get a bachelor's degree. We have to have a separate articulation agreement with a college like Bethel College locally, or Franklin University, or some of those kinds, where they tell us specifically what they will and won't accept, so that we can advise our students to take this specific curriculum. Some of those things that have to translate, and I'll give you an example. If you're going to transfer all your business credits, they prescribe what has to be in. They take the business law course. Business law, which I've taught a few times, you've even come in and via Zoom and spoken to a class. In business law, there is a specific textbook that we have to use. There is a specific final exam we have to administer. You know, and that's the only way that the four-year colleges are going to accept the credit. Other classes like principles of management, you know, we have to pass muster with them in terms of what goes into the course, what the course objectives are, and so on. But they're not looking for that same comprehensive final exam that everybody has to take. So it just varies from one to the next. Now, when you're talking about someone like Van Allen Lubin, who played at four schools, he played at Notre Dame for a year, he played at Vanderbilt, he played at North Carolina, and then he played at North Carolina State. It's all a matter of what credits will the next school accept, and how many of them. So I would imagine that, you know, the courses he took at Notre Dame pretty much came across and were accepted at Vanderbilt. I'm guessing that. I don't know that for sure, and I don't know how I would even know that for sure. But I would guess that pretty much what he took at Notre Dame went to Vanderbilt, and probably what he took at Vanderbilt and Notre Dame, what was accepted there, probably came across to North Carolina. Probably. But I have no idea if that's true or not. If he was hoping to get a degree out of this, I am sure some credits fell by the wayside, that there were some things he took and they just said, nope, we're not taking that one. And as a result, you know, probably took a lot of summer school and that kind of stuff anyway. So he may have been able to make up the credits. He's not a dumb guy. I remember him from when he was here in South Bend. He's not a dumb guy, but he was a professional basketball player who was a free agent every year, and he exercised his options whenever he could. And along the way, whatever college credits he was able to get he may have considered a bonus, or may, he may have said, look, I'm going to wind up with a degree one way or the other. It's just a matter of where it's from.
Well, do they still have the, to a certain degree, and I never transferred, so I'm, that's why I'm asking these questions. I seem to recall that there was a two-step process to this, that I could pretty much every course maybe I took at Notre Dame counted as a course to go, you know, because Notre Dame's a pretty good place. But if I was going to go get a finance degree at, you know, Illinois, they wanted like 80% of the finance classes to be at Illinois.
Could be, yeah.
I mean, it was there were, they used to have times that you had to take a huge percentage of the stuff in your, quote, major at the school you graduated in. I wonder if that's even around anymore.
Well, it is. I'll tell you what, we get in the summer, as an example, we'll get students who will come and take their principles of accounting in the summer with us because they're, you know, they come home from Purdue or they come home from Indiana, wherever, you know, wherever they may be going to school, University of Indianapolis or something like that. But they're home, they say, let's get a course out of the way, and the credits will transfer. They make sure that you know, before they enroll, that they'll transfer, and they come in as a guest student and just take the one course in the summer and get those credits transferred. Part of the reason that they want, a lot of students want to do that in the summertime is that they is that that's a it's not that accounting's such a hard course, but what it is a lot of, it's always a lot of work. Your principles of accounting and your financial reporting courses and those kinds of things are always a lot of work, and students don't want that competing with their other four or five courses.
They still give you the workbook you got to fill in?
No, I'm pretty sure we don't use a lot of workbooks.
You actually learned the stuff when you did that.
Tom, they have these newfangled computer thingies now.
You know, you actually had to learn the thing when you did. You did actually put one on the right side and one on the left side. It actually got, you know.
Yeah. I remember the ledger sheets and all that. No, we do not give our students ledger sheets.
It was like the Karate Kid, wax the car, paint the fence, same sort of thing.
No. You don't wax the car. You wax on.
Wax on and you wax off.
You wax off, yes.
But you actually did.
We aren't even going to talk about wax off.
Yeah, you actually did learn the stuff that way, though. I mean, to a huge basic thing. Not that you can't learn it the other way, but. Anyway, what do you make of not so much the you know, I know I'm a voice in the wilderness on this regarding what's going on with the money and stuff. What do you make of the idea that we seem to be willing to and not just this administration, we're going back a bunch. We seem to be willing to trade obvious inflation for policy. No matter who it is, whatever administration it is, and yet I really believe, because I mean I was a disciple of the man, Milton Friedman, who says it is the cruelest tax of all. I really believe that. I don't know if I'm accomplishing anything by talking anybody else into believing that, but it absolutely is the cruelest tax of all, and I don't know why somehow it's gotten totally out of the mainstream vernacular. Nobody talks about it. People once in a while bitch about it. They bring up gas prices, and then somebody says, don't worry, they're coming down because the war is going to be over, and that's sort of the end of it. It's not the end of it, Kevin. It's the beginning of it, for God's sake. I mean, why do we have to learn this all over again, that 10 years from now, maybe you and I are retired somewhere, somebody's going to wake up and say, man, this is the same thing that happened before. Why did we let it happen again?
When you say nobody's talking about it, I don't think that's true. You may not see it on CNBC as much, which is, I know is where you... you know, you're kind of focused throughout the day,
or Fox Business. I mean, whatever.
Yeah, or whatever. But I hear a fair amount of talk about inflation and rates and money
supply.
Stuff we talk about on the show. I hear discussion of it.
What in what venue is there? Are they absolutely pointing fingers? It's where it's happening and who's doing it and why?
Well, expound on that a little bit, because I'm not sure what
it is coming from the Fed at the direction of somebody who's benefiting from it. I mean, it's not just sort of happening. I mean, it's happening on purpose.
Okay.
I mean, it's not like, you know, nobody decided to pour his money into the $95 billion in the last 7 weeks into the balance sheet and all the multiplier effects. And look what happens to the market, for God's sake. But as long as that goes up, And evidently, they have enough, I think what it is, Kevin, and this is a good thing, by the way, because a lot of my clients, they have enough people in this country, maybe through IRAs and 401ks, that are willing to make the trade-off of their stocks and their houses going up, even though the rest of them getting stuck where the sun don't shine. And the difference, I think, you see, which is a lot different than during the 70s and 80s when not that many people had stock, the difference is the other people that don't have that and are just getting the raw end of it don't really have a voice. It is, to me, it's gone beyond, you know, now I'm swinging from Friedman to George Stigler. It's becoming a behavioral thing. The people who just pay the high prices, they can't go home and say, well, that's okay, my Microsoft was up yesterday, and I made more money there than I paid in gas prices. I don't think those people have any kind of a voice. To me, it's becoming very behavioral and becoming actually very divisive. And it's only going to get worse if it keeps going on. Now, hopefully it won't. The war will end and gas prices will go down and the Fed will mend what they did, which they don't ever seem to want to, but say they do. I mean, that could happen, and I'm hoping for that, but it is incredibly divisive because I can name you the winners and the losers here. You know, I've been able to do it for 40 years, but I never thought I'd have to do it again is my point.
Well, a lot of the divisiveness is because I think what you're seeing is what I would call agenda spending. And by that I mean, there's a lot of money that goes in, and this is all, it's still out of control spending. We just have this incredible habit of saying, because we think it's a good idea, we should do it no matter what the cost. Yeah, well, you know, I think a brand new Lamborghini is a good idea too, but I can't afford it, so I don't buy it. That's the missing logic that we don't get out of government. Nevertheless, it is all agenda spending. So you're seeing, for instance, a lot of money going into what would be a foreign policy agenda, and you know this. It's pretty articulated in the national security strategy, so you can see what's going on with it. Whether you like it or not, you might find it appalling, you might find it going on, but whether you support the agenda or not, just like, at least in name, in the last administration, we had a whole lot of agenda spending as well. It was, you know, a lot of it was built around green energy, although a lot of it didn't really come to fruition. A lot of it found its way, you know, into third-party hands, non-government entities of various kinds, and whether it was spent properly or spent as sold. I don't know whether to say spent as intended, but I'll say spent as it was sold to the public. Whether that happened or not, at least you had this articulated agenda about what we were doing, and so some people were willing to give it a pass because the green agenda is really important and I love it and I want to do it. Other people were not willing to give it a pass, just like now. If you say, Iran is costing us a ton of money, if you believe that it's still a good idea, it's a right thing to do, then you're going to give the spending that's associated with it a pass. And I think that's what you're seeing when people talk about what's in, what's out, what we're doing, what we're not doing. I think it really gets tied into that kind of logic, which is a little weird, but that's what we're seeing.
I think you're absolutely correct, except for one thing.
Me when you think I'm right.
No, I mean you're absolutely correct in what's driving it on the first level of the chessboard. Okay, and I'll put them both in the same category, the great big beautiful bill of this guy and the other, the whatever, we're gonna fund America's infrastructure from the other guy. The other guy says, well, okay, we're gonna do this, and everybody in Inglewood's gonna have five bips on their phone, and it's gonna be so productive that we're gonna get all these checks from income tax, and it's all going to work out right. And I'm sitting there, you and I at both time going, what the hell is he talking about? But this guy comes in and says, we're going to cut all these taxes for some people. And oh, by the way, it's going to make people so more productive they're going to end up getting more money. Well, that's all bullshit, too. So, I mean, we have two guys doing it. Now, but that, you and I think, we're on the part about we're spending too much dough. One side's doing it one way, one side's doing it the other, and they both don't seem to make a whole hell of a lot of sense. Now, the question is, how do you pay for it? Now, you could tax the hell out of people to do it. Well, these guys aren't going to do that. The Bush people didn't. That's what started the whole mess the last time. And the people in Vietnam didn't. And I think those were Democrats. Johnson.
Actually, they did have one tax increase, though, but the Supreme Court struck it down.
Okay, you're right. We'll have to talk about the regressive. Anyway, but you're right. They did have one tax increase.
They may not like it, but there was a tax increase.
Right. But there was. There's no real attempt to say, okay, we're going to Iraq. When Obama, where the hell he went? He went someplace. We're going to this place. By the way, it's going to cost us $400 billion, and since our taxes this year are going to be $1 trillion, so over the next 2 years, we're going to put a 20% kicker on your taxes, and we're going to make up for it. Nobody will think of doing that. I mean, that's just...
I've always been of a mind that that's exactly what we should do with each of these excursions that we go on, because people are very gung-ho about them, but if you turn around and tell me what's going to come out of my wallet, I might not be so gung-ho.
Yeah. Well, and then you could...
And if the public is still in and says, okay, let's do it, that's worth it, if that's the general sentiment, cool, do it.
Well, it comes down to everything we talk about, Kevin, and it's amazing to me how all the different topics we talk about, and they all come together. The Bears Stadium, what do you mean? Everybody else has a stadium. Why can't they get the tax break? Why don't all the friggin' people that want the Bears to have a stadium send in $1,000 and be done with it? And the people who don't, it's all about forcing other people to pay what you want for what you want, right? And that's...
Well, that's what taxation is anyway.
Well, but not really.
To do it.
Not really. I mean, if 50 of us live in a small town and we say we need Barney Fife to drive around and make sure we all collectively decide that's what we want, and we hire Barney Fife, that's not... I suppose there'd be one guy that says he wants a speed and doesn't want a Barney Fife, but always be somebody. But here's the part I don't...
It's still coerced, Tom. It's just, you know, do we think it's okay or not? But still, it's enforced, is it not?
Yeah, well, we can borrow the money, which we've done dramatically over the last... And now we have a guy who is somehow trying to piss off all the people that are lending us all the dough, which I don't even quite get that. I don't know if he reads... But let's leave that aside. But the part that I think that somehow it's dropped out of the education, it's dropped out of something, is just the act of inflation creates massive winners and massive losers. And there doesn't seem to be... However you get there, whether it's the Democrats doing their crap or whether it's the Republicans... However you get that, when you decide you're going to finance the thing by more money in the system, the example is, just because he happens to be president, the example is, who's the biggest winner on this? It's friggin', I'll use the name, but it's everybody like him, it's Trump. When did he buy the Doral? 15 years ago? He's got a mortgage on it. Okay, well, if you inflate the cost of the rooms from $250 to $500 over the next 5 years, his mortgage doesn't go up. His fixed payment is the same. Just like the government. If they start paying you back 10-year bonds or notes, wherever they are, 10 years from now, they're going to pay you back with stuff that's worth half as much as what you gave them. Therein lies the cruelty of it. That Trump is going to be able to walk to the bank and say, here's my mortgage on a Doral. He's happy as a clam. The poor bastard who's paying the $550, of course, if you're paying $550, maybe you got some dough anyway. If he doesn't have some stock, or if he doesn't have his own Doral, he's the part that goes over the fence last. That's the part that I'm missing here. I understand the policy, and I understand, Kevin, if you and I were in charge, two of us were in the Oval Office, we might say stuff like the GI Bill, for instance. Well, we don't know how we're going to pay for it, but we think this is a good idea. Well, I'm going to say the GI Bill turned out to be, as an investment, probably one of the best things the government's ever done. How much more tax do you think you got from people that you put through school, especially at the rates in 1948? That are now probably, maybe, well, most of them aren't, but they were still working 15 years ago, and they're paying more in taxes than 10 times more a year than you ever paid for their education, right? It could have been the most best investment ever. So it's not like government doesn't ever want to have an investment. I mean, some of the nuclear plants that were supposed to last 20 years, they maybe were never really justified. But guess what? It's 40 years later and they're still running. So maybe they were. It's not like there shouldn't be some sort of government investment. You know what I'm saying? But at least people ought to understand that if you do it the inflationary way, you got serious winners and losers. And I just don't see that anybody even realizing that. I never see that on TV.
I would also argue that if you run crappy public school systems and you don't educate people in how to think about these kinds of things, then they're just going to cheer the agenda items without looking critically at the...
I'm with you. But how do we lose this collective knowledge? Maybe it's been a long time since the 80s. I get it, but... I mean, it was on everybody. It wasn't the tip of everybody's tongue then. The money supply number was the big event of the week, for God's sake.
Well, we don't do economics education anymore, so...
Isn't that scary? What is the early... there was an article... I got the headline from my Tribune subscription, and it was about... United Center closed down, the courts filed away, and the ice is melted, and it was like the... Has there ever been a worse year for two teams in the same building? One team's like the second worst in hockey, and the other one's the third worst in basketball or something, or fourth worst?
About the only thing I could say is at least the Blackhawks have been accumulating young talent, and it needs to start growing up, for sure, but at least they're accumulating young talent and have some promise, and maybe they can even add, you know, a few veterans along the way. You know, in other words, they've gotten their Kane, Taves, Duncan Keith. You know, those they've drafted all of those guys. So now can they start getting their Marian Hossa or somebody like that to those kind of guys to fill in their roster and start getting to be a really good team? The Bulls, man, they got nothing working for them.
I don't see
they tried to tank and they sucked at tanking.
Well, but what good does it do to tank two or three more spots in the NBA? I mean,
all you're doing in the NBA is, unless you're right at the bottom and you're guaranteed a top three or four pick, whatever it is you're trying to improve your odds in the lottery, which is just, you know. If you can improve your odds all the way up to 10% of getting a top pick, well, I suppose that's better than 1%, but it really is folly. That's what I said. They suck at tanking.
That's a cruel tax on the guy who has a season ticket.
Well, and you know what? It's weird because the Bulls really do. They're one of the leading attendance teams in the NBA.
It's got to be. They got to be the highest ticket prices or close to it.
Not very entertaining.
It's obviously none of my business, nor do I suppose care other than I kind of like basketball. I don't see how out of this whole mess, with all these players look like they're all sort of the same, they're all kind of swing men, they all I want to do is shoot three, nobody plays any defense. It's how you can single out Billy Donovan, who might actually be a terrific guy and coach, how can you single him out as doing a good job or a bad job? That the two guys above him, we're all screwed up for not giving them to players. I don't see those guys play any sense of defense. I don't see them do anything. They walk to the bench, everybody slaps hands and put another three, four guys in to look the same as the guys you just had in there. And I'm not talking about all being black. I'm talking about the fact that they're all the same size. They all do the same thing. They can't wait for a three. It's the craziest thing I've ever come across. It doesn't resemble basketball. You watch some of these other teams, and they're actually playing basketball. I mean, they know what they're doing. They play D. I mean, You watch, Oklahoma City play Cleveland or something, or you got a good team, a good game.
And that observation is that I don't watch the Bulls, so I'm taking your word for it. I don't doubt it for a minute. But I'm the kind of fan that if you play crappy basketball, you lose me.
Well, I guess my point is he could be terrific, but watching the game, I'm sitting there. Kevin and I could be the coach. How could it be any worse? maybe all the players be fighting each other or something. I don't know. I guess we could always make it worse. But
the only thing I can really say on Donovan's behalf is that he's got a track record elsewhere.
Yeah.
So So at least, you know, you can lean on that and say, you know, to the point of saying, well, if it ain't the coach, then who is it? And of course, they have cleaned house in their upper level. And the only open question is whether Donovan wants to stick around, because he's under contract, so he can stick around if he wants to. But this might just be his time to go off and do something else. And, you know, I've seen the guy work for the Bulls for quite a while now, and he seems like an okay guy. He's got a good track record as a coach. I hope he can go do something that makes him happy, because I can't imagine that coaching the Bulls has made him very happy lately.
Who's even going to run the draft? They get rid of everybody. If he leaves, then what? You and I are going to run it?
You can run it. I'm fine without it.
Yeah, me too. I don't really... I don't know. What does it pay? We get a 5-year contract, I'd do it. Even though we're only going to be there for a week. Isn't that the way you do things now? That's the way you do it? See it on MTV? You know, if it's a long enough contract and less enough time we have to spend, we'd do it, right?
Yeah. So, yeah, Well, there's a long way to go. They'll probably have somebody hired by then, probably. Although it's the Bulls, and, you know, it's a Reinsdorf organization, so the dysfunction could lead them to not having somebody on board, or having somebody on board at the last minute and scrapping everything. They do have some interesting young players. They, you know, Josh Giddey is interesting. Matas Bouzelis is interesting. And the guy they drafted last year did not spend the year playing in the NBA. Spent the year playing in the G League, but because he's only 18 years old, so they may have brought talent there that who knows if it's going to turn into anything, or if it was just a dumb boondoggle to draft the guy. But he's an overseas player.
Well, the one I heard the other day could have been the, I don't know if it's their fault, somebody's fault, nobody's fault. It could have been the dumbest move I've ever... They got a draft pick this year from somebody because it's not, it was lottery protected or something. It was 5 years ago when they traded Corey Marketing, who was their number one pick. And he's been playing really good ball for somebody. I don't know if he's a star.
He's been on a few teams, but I think in his time in Utah, he was a pretty good player, yeah.
So, I mean, now 5 years later, they're getting like the 16th pick or something, or somewhere down there?
NBA deals are weird. Part of the reason they're weird is because teams are not allowed to trade, you know, like consecutive first-round draft picks, that kind of thing, so you have to work around that rule, too.
In regards to the basketball, this is one we talk all the time, and I would love to get my hands around it. I actually, because I still like, what's his name? The guy who played on the Bulls, the coach of Golden State. Steve Kerr. I like him, always have. I think he's a real gentleman and want him to do well. And plus, I like some of the guys who play for him, even though I guess Butler's still out, right, all year. I thought they get a couple guys back from injury. Maybe they'll make a little run at it because they're in this play-in thing. I go to turn it on. Sure enough, I can't believe every one of the play-in games is on Prime. How do you expect? I'm sure Prime paid for it. You know, like you say, they're short-term oriented. How do you expect somebody like me, who has no dog in this fight whatsoever, to possibly catch on to a team and want to watch him run through it if you don't let me watch the first few games? Now I'm not going to watch any of them. Screw them. I have to watch some of them at the Triple League when Boston comes on, because that's what they'll have on. But all of a sudden, I've totally lost interest not being able to watch the first two games. Am I just being much of a dodo or what?
Well,
yes and yes.
You probably are, but that not related to this. So we'll let that one slide. But the I think, you know, that they're trying to think, they're, you know, act like they're future thinking and so on, getting into streaming. I just think they're just crushing their ability to build a fan base. And I suppose if they wanted to do a lot more streaming, go ahead, knock yourself out. But what they're doing in the process by moving it around and making, you know, how do you track down games? It's a moving target. I just think that's a really, really foolish way to do it, because you have people who, you know, they don't know where to look for your games on a nightly basis. So if you wanted to sit down and say, well, you know what, not doing anything, got a couple hours, I'd love to watch an NBA game, let me see. Oh, they're on Prime. Sorry, don't have a Prime subscription. Oh, they're on Peacock. You know, don't have Peacock subscription. You know, or even if you do, how do you find them? I really think it's just a bet. The moving targets, put them in one place or a very limited number of places and keep them there.
What, I mean, we always talk.
Make it easy for your fans to find you.
Well, we also have, you know, a lot of people on the show that for some reason we're trying to, you know, point fingers at the criminals we want to see, whatever. Some people don't like, you know, people from other countries here. Some people don't like antitrust in hospitals. I mean, I'm not talking, I'm just saying on the show, I'm going to say, Kevin, that if you and I opened up a wine store and had exclusive on some wine that came from God knows where, it's really good. And in order to get a bottle of that wine, you had to buy a pizza. I'm going to say somebody will complain against us. The pizza joint on the block will complain against us the next day, and we'll be told to not do that. Because that is an absolute, either it's the Robinson-Patman Act or the Clayton Act, one of the two, you can't string two things together like that. And yet here we are in front of everybody.
Adam, I'm not sure your example supports that, because you do have all. If you have the market cornered on the wine and nobody can get it anywhere else, and so yeah, you can't create a tying agreement like that.
Okay, but this is very close. I mean, I'm not a lawyer, but the idea that in order to watch this NBA game, you have to become a member of Amazon, that's insane. I mean, for just about anything else. I don't think that's legal at all.
Yeah, I'd have to think that through.
Well, I mean, everybody thinks, I mean, just like it wasn't legal for Amazon to not pay taxes for the first 20 years of their existence.
Whatever, that's not related. That's not the same thing.
No, but it's people that are big seem to ignore all the rules. And you can see that all over the place, right? Certainly see in hospitals and stuff.
The broadcast rights, they're not. Yeah, they do have a monopoly on the NBA, but I don't see that as the same kind of violation that you're describing.
It's a tied agreement.
Carl's on. Carl, you know this stuff too. Do you agree, disagree? I don't think that's an actionable item on this.
I don't think it's actionable, but I think it's discussable. Let's put it that way.
Well, yeah, I mean, so here's the thing when it comes to that. If I own a thing, okay, it's mine, am I allowed to dictate the terms under which it's sold? And the answer as to whether or not it's, the answer is yes, depends on whether or not what I am doing inherently is violative of competition. In other words, have I colluded with other people, okay, in order to restrain trade? That's where the violation of the Sherman and Clayton Acts comes from. Robinson Patman, by the way, only applies to goods. So it would not apply to a streaming service under any set of circumstances, because that's a service. Robinson Patman does not apply to services.
Okay, but the question...
So the question, Chief, is does a basketball, does the game of basketball have a single source right of control over the televising of basketball games? In other words, is there competition between basketball, you know, is that a definable thing that you can restrain the trade of? And I suspect the answer in a court And from a standpoint of the Sherman and Clayton axis, no. Now, if you were to go further and say, all right, the NBA, the NFL, Major League Baseball, of course, Major League Baseball has some funky exceptions that are specifically there. But all of these sports are only going to be on Peacock. And all these different entities get together and do that. That is a clear violation.
Yeah.
Okay, but I'm kind of going down a different, a nastier little road here. You guys are taking the high road.
I'm just telling you what the law actually says.
I know. I'm talking about when I keep saying a pizza joint. There was a pizza joint on 95th Street. It's still there.
Right.
And for a while, they said if you buy an extra large pizza, we'll sell you this pretty nice bottle of wine for $10.
Mm-hmm.
And lo and behold, it wasn't a month before all the people who actually had the liquor stores on 95th Street put in a huge complaint under whatever act saying they were selling the wine under cost.
Okay, that's an illegal time.
All right, where I'm going with this is, we know, the three of us know, Kevin probably better, that this thing on Prime is going to get less people than if it's on Channel 7, I think. So they're using it as a loss leader to do something else. What's the something else to make you buy Prime?
Well, yes, I understand it. But the thing is that the question, so if you are selling something below cost as part of a tied sale, so here was a classic example. This actually, back when we used to have a government that actually did some enforcement of the law.
When was that?
It was during the time when there used to be mainframe computers.
Okay.
And Amdahl came up with a computer that was essentially object code compatible with the IBM mainframes. Okay.
Whatever that means.
Well, it means that you can run IBM's
operating system on it. Basically.
Okay.
It means
you can run IBM's operating system. Okay, because it is, you can load the software from a different company on this machine. All right.
Well, IBM could not have liked that.
Well, IBM didn't like it one little bit, and so IBM at the time had a couple of things that were rather interesting. One of them was that you had to, in order to be able to license VM and MVS, which was their operating environment, you had to have a service agreement from IBM on your equipment. Well, that's kind of hard to do when the equipment's made by Amdahl. Okay.
Yep.
Needless to say, Amdahl sued, and so did the government. And IBM got their wiener shoved in the door and then slammed.
But how many years did that take?
Well, a while. But here's the thing: that was a blatantly unlawful tied sale. Okay, and IBM thought they were going to get away with it. Well, they were wrong. They didn't get away with it.
I have to ask: in the meantime, were you able to do it, or were you prohibited from doing it?
Well, there were people who did it, and then IBM came after them. Okay, it said, oh, by the way, and ultimately IBM lost those cases.
The reason I ask is there have been companies that eventually lost but put the other guy out of the business in the meantime.
Well, they didn't put Amdahl on.
Okay, they did. All right.
That was the MCI arrangement, but...
They didn't manage to put they did not put Amdahl on business. So yeah, and this was and there was but this was a really I mean this was a really big thing, and it was one of the seminal tied sale antitrust cases.
Yeah, and I remember it. I remember it being a big deal as well. But I don't remember the specifics of the case. It's the question is, can you get a restraining order to stop them from doing it? Restraining order is based on the likelihood that the plaintiff will prevail. I don't remember anything like that happening, but I don't remember it not happening either.
Yeah, it was quite a big thing, and really the question. I mean, here's the other thing that's interesting about that. What came from this in terms of being a good in the general sense, because you know, how many people do you think buy mainframes, right? I mean, even then, how many people bought mainframes, right? They were computers that were, I mean, some universities had them, but in general, only the very largest firms had them, simply because they were so damned expensive.
What did everybody else have when there was, what was the?
Well, there were several other classes of computers. In the mini computer world, you had things that were based on the PDP-11, which was a smaller version of the TOPS 10 computers that DEC sold. Now, they were completely different architecturally. They did not run the same code. They did not they didn't have the same internal architecture at all. In fact, the TOPS 10 and was the operating system that ran on the PDP 10s, and that was a really weird machine because it was the 36-bit word, which is
that was digital.
Yeah, that was digital equipment, and that was a really, I mean, 36 bits is kind of weird because it's not a power two. Okay, everybody else was, you know, was in the 32-bit world, but and 16-bit for that matter. But there were smaller machines, and then after the large PDP 10 line essentially became an obsolete dinosaur, you had the VAX systems, which were available all the way from mainframe-style machines, all the way down to what we call microVAXs that were the size of a small little tower computer, not a whole lot bigger than the tower computer that sits on your desk today. And we did quite a lot of work with those before MCS was an internet company, before there was an internet. And it's simply because we found ways to source things that were compatible with the MicroVax line in particular, that were a hell of a lot cheaper than what Digital wanted for the same thing. So, needless to say, this made us very popular with companies that had those computers.
What happened to all the other guys that were involved, the Sperry Rands and the unit? They all get taken over? They all just die or what?
They all pretty much died. I mean, the thing is people, a lot of people believe that, like, there's not really, you know, there wasn't really much competitive pressure in that general area. That's absolute garbage. There was a huge amount of competitive pressure in the in the different size and type of business computers. I mean, one of the reasons that my company was able to, you know, to exist originally, we did some software development, but we were part of the group that figured out where you could get compatible PCs, and we blew Compaq and IBM's PCs out of a number of fairly large corporations in Chicago because we were able to source components, put them together, assemble them, and we had superior machines that cost less money. And that, I mean, you know, better, faster, cheaper. Okay.
Well, but a lot of people locked into the, this isn't more.
Unisys, was that Sperry and Burroughs? Was that the merger that became Unisys?
Well, yeah, and the thing that's funny
remember, you know, this is ancient history to me now, even to me.
Yeah, the funny thing about Burroughs was that the very first money I ever made as a teenager programming a computer was actually hacking the object code of a Burroughs bookkeeping machine because the company wanted $3,000 to cut another paper tape to load a tax rate change. Okay, now, I mean, if you think, it was literally one number that had to be altered for the tax rate, right? But they wanted $3,000 to make another paper tape that probably would have taken them, you know, 10 minutes to do. It took me it took me 4.5 hours to figure out where it was in the machine after the tape was loaded, and then develop a procedure that the bookkeeper could, okay, load the tape, then press this button, enter this, enter that, push this, okay, it's changed, now go ahead and you know, run your payroll.
Were the other companies that Kevin's rattling off, were they, well, I remember this from when I was used to do AFEs, where people trying to buy these things. Were the other ones purchasable? The IBM ones, we always just rent it. I mean, IBM never sold. Did they ever sell you anything, or did they just rent stuff?
Well, there was some of both. And part of the issue was that there was these things. I mean, you know, if you look at what was actually required to have one of these things, the amount of power they consumed and the cooling requirement was extreme. and particularly in some of the larger. Now, I don't think Deck ever made water cooled stuff, but IBM, some of the IBM mainframes are water cooled.
Yeah, the 3090 came out, and that was water cooled just like your car.
What was one before that, Kevin?
So the infrastructure, the system 370s were before the 3090.
Yeah,
well, I think there was a 2025 before that.
Well, there've been a number of different lines, but the thing is that I mean the infrastructure requirement to have one of those things in your building was ridiculous.
Pullman had about 10 of them.
Expensive as hell.
They had like 8 or 10 of them in a concrete building down in near Dallas, and there was an area there that a lot of these things they were like a pillbox. I mean, if a tornado hit it, it wasn't going to go down. It was cooled just properly. I know the name. The numbers started with twos because we had about 7 of them, and we were paying $20,000 a month.
You know, I don't remember each. I remember 1401s. I remember System 360s. I remember System 370s.
Yeah.
And I remember the 3090 series rolling out.
Well, whatever came out after.
Different world after that.
One of those did the work of like 6 or 7 of the old ones.
Well, and that was what ultimately killed the. See, the thing that ultimately that led to the demise, the reason that even into the 1980s and the 1990-ish time frame, that mainframes were still in fairly heavy use, was I/O. It was not actually processing power. It was that moving data in and out of the machine. Is if you've got a large data set, well,
right? Yeah.
So I mean that becomes a problem. And storage was also in the beginning, if you will, you didn't have. I mean, your disk drive was the size of a washing machine, and it held almost nothing, right? Compared to today,
even I remember some of them were like a 2-high filing cabinet about that size. And yet that it cost you $10,000 and get you 10 meg.
Right. I mean, well, one of the things that DEC, started doing and was I don't know if they were actually the leader, but the one of them. So before there were disks, there was drum storage.
Yeah.
It was even more limited and even more stupid money.
L.I. Van Lines had a tape storage system.
You would load and unload things to disk as you were using them, but you couldn't afford all the disk that you needed to have everything online. So yeah, you would
go to tape.
Tape librarian was a job that was very important in companies.
Yeah, well, and the tape drives were huge too. They were six feet tall, the size of a rack cabinet, and well, because because of the speed at which they operated, in order to try to get some kind of reasonable performance, the way you managed this, of course, the tape is can break, right? So the buffering for the movement was actually done with vacuum columns. So you had a loop of tape in the vacuum column, and that's what took up the shock.
Wow.
So, I mean, that was the, but I mean, these were all, this was all solutions to real problems. And then DEC, one of the things that DEC did, and they were in front of this, was they still were LP, record-sized platters. But they came up with the RL01 and their RL02, which were removable packs, still went into a disk drive that was about the size of a washing machine, but they were much more reasonable in cost, and they held 5 and 10 megabytes.
Well, this is, this is great. I'm just curious. In my economic mind, I just keep saying, okay, one firm, to get back to basketball or baseball, one firm is going to pay $50 million for X number of games, they're going to be able to do, they have this many listeners, and they're going to get this much from commercials, and that's how I would make my analysis if I was doing it. And if somebody else said, okay, we're going to pay twice as much, but we're going to do it in a way where we got half as many people listening to it, so we can only charge half as much for commercials, I'm going to say, what's going on here?
Well, this is, Chief...
Let me jump in real quickly and just say, because I've really enjoyed the trip down memory lane.
Me too, I mean...
But I got to sign off. I got to get dressed and head to the office. So
don't omit the get dressed part.
So I'll catch you guys next week.
All right, bud.
All right. Chief. The thing is that we if you look at all the damage that has been done. I mean, there's places where it doesn't happen. All right, I'll give you an example. You know, competition is the lifeblood of innovation, all right, when you really get down to it.
Well, that's why people don't want any competition in their industry.
Well, of course, they don't want it in any industry if they can avoid it, right? So for years here, if you wanted high-speed internet access, your only real choice was to put up with Charter Spectrum because, you know, it was a cable company, right? And you had DSL available, you had a few other things available, but they were all slow. You know, if you really wanted to be crazy, you could go get a Hughes satellite dish and put it up. And people that had no wires other than power into their, you know, cabin up on a mountaintop somewhere, that was your only choice. Well, a few years ago, Cub comes through here with fiber. Now, Cub is the power company here, where I live. And they come through here with fiber. They put it in originally... partly because they want to use the data capacity to monitor and control their electrical grid. A perfectly reasonable thing to do, right? I mean, yeah. You want to keep track of what's going on with phase imbalances and things like this. Okay. So, you know, and the other thing is the electronic meters. I mean, they don't have to send a guy around to read your meter. All right. Well, guess what? You need to have communications facilities to be able to, you know, to make these things work. The other thing is, if you don't pay your bill, they can turn you off by pushing a button.
That's the problem. They don't have to send a guy out there to turn off.
Well, they don't have to send a guy out there to, you know, maybe get shot when he goes take the meter out of your box, right? From their standpoint, this is the other side of it, though, of course, is when you pay, they can turn it back on in 5 seconds, too. So all of these things come in there. And when they get this in... this area, all of a sudden, you can buy gigabit symmetrical service, which is way faster than what the cable company is selling. And instead of 80 bucks a month plus taxes, it ends up being about 90. It's 65 taxes included. Okay? Now, how's this? Well, the innovation... that these guys came up with. And I don't know if you remember this, Chief, but about 2 years ago, we talked about this on the show, and I wrote a column on it as well. I saw all this glass going up all over reasonably rural areas of the country. And I knew what it was, because I know what I'm looking at.
That stuff costs less than copper, though, right?
Well, here's always been the problem. All right? It's not the glass. It's the terminations. It's the repeaters. The termination is... Putting the little snap-on ends that you plug into things on fiber cable is a skill, right? It is a skilled task. It is not something you can give to a monkey and say, do this, and expect that it's actually going to work when he's done. It just isn't.
By monkey, you mean a guy like me who trades stuff for people.
Yeah, or a guy like me. I know how to use the equipment, but it's not something you can teach somebody in 2 hours. Right, it's not like I got a cable coming on my wall with cable TV. Okay, I buy a crimper and a box of of cable ends, and I can put it on there and it'll work and it's fine. That ain't how. That is not true when it comes to fiber optic stuff. So, and the other thing is that in the long haul, they use lasers. So there is a no bullshit optical risk if you manage to end up with one of those pointed into your eye. The sign, don't look at laser with remaining eye, is actually appropriate.
Oh, yeah.
The reality, though, is that it's the electronics that have always been the problem and the cost, along with the termination. Well, these crazy bastards figured out how to use... Now, wave division has been a thing for quite a while. It was just becoming a big thing when I was leaving the internet business. And essentially it was the reason that you put all this cross-country fiber in decades ago back in the 1990s. And then all of a sudden, you really haven't had to, you know, you paid stupid money for the easements and to put this stuff in. But then all of a sudden, magically, the same fiber ends up being able to carry 50 times as much data as it used to. And the reason is they figured out how to do optical division, where basically different colors of light down the same piece of glass. All right. So where you had one data stream, now you got 5 or 10 or 20. Well, these crazy bastards figured out how to do the actual division and splitting, if you will, using prisms in both directions. Now, that is a ridiculous game changer for cost, because a prism never wears out and it requires no electricity.
Yeah, that's unreal.
All right, well, so that's how these things are all being put in. That's the innovation that made this all possible. All right, for you be able to buy gigabit service for that kind of money. And the thing is, the cable company has, there's nothing they can do about this. There's no response other than for them to put, you know, pull fiber in, because the reality of it is that coaxial cable requires powered repeaters every so often, and they're amplifiers, because they amplify signal in both directions. And they require electricity. So not only do they wear out, they're subject to storm damage risk, you know, electrical strike, you know, lightning strike on, you know, on the cable can destroy the equipment, et cetera, et cetera. Glass doesn't care. It's impervious to lightning. And oh, by the way, there's no power being used because it's a prism. So unless the splitter actually gets physically hit by a lightning bolt, which it won't because it doesn't conduct electricity, this stuff's going to work for the next 50 years.
Well, to get back to my rant earlier about
my point, Chief, is that that's what competition did.
Yeah, without a doubt. But nobody wants, what would they say in grad school, competition is the greatest thing for every other industry but yours?
Except yours, right. And the problem we have in so many different areas is that, you know, here's another example. When Trump was in office the first time, one of the things he did was mandated that all hospitals provide actual pricing in customer-facing portals where you could get to it.
Yeah, but nobody does.
Exactly. None of them have done it, and no one's gone to jail.
Yeah, but it wasn't Trump. The Supreme Court had 2 decisions that way before him.
Well, the way back to 1979.
Well, the thing of it is, you're talking about a guy, I don't want to talk about him, you're talking about a guy who says that, but has no more desire to see it follow through. He goes to his Justice Department. He says, go pick up people that don't look like they're white. The same people could be doing this.
Okay, Chief. And oh, by the way, Barack Obama did exactly the same effing thing. And so did Joe Biden. And so did Bush. And so did Reagan. And so did Clinton.
Okay, but
and by the way, all of this was after 1979.
I understand that. What I'm saying is, you said he signed an executive order, but it had zero follow-through. At least if he read the damn executive order, he should have realized what he was doing. And if you and I looked at it, let's put it this way, if you and I looked at it and we thought an executive order were worth a crap, which I don't, we would have said, I'm signing this for a reason. And all of a sudden talk about what you and I talk about every week and say, wait a minute, there's 2 Supreme Court cases, there's all this stuff, and they're still not doing it? That's a Justice Department problem. It's not an executive order proclamation.
Well, of course this is a Justice Department problem, but the thing is this. You are the problem, the basic issue we have, right? I mean, you look at what's going on right now with this, you know, with all this crap in the market today, all right? You have Pavlov's dog. Literally, a Pavlovian dog type of reaction with everything that's been related to this war.
It has nothing to do with the war, you know that.
Well, excuse me, every time there's another tweet on Truth Social or whatever have you, the reflex is there, because every time so far, for the last, ever since 2008, every time, oh yeah, man, we're worried about inflation, we're going to keep this up. Oh, really? So explain to me why we have a Fed funds rate that is below the federal deficit as a percentage of GDP. Okay. By the way,
we also have it below inflation, which you and I can't borrow there.
Well, of course we can't. And oh, by the way, Goldman, Bank of America, Chase, all these other guys, They simply charge you 30% interest on your credit card.
Right.
So they don't care a bit because the spread is enough to cover the inflation. And guess who gets it in the keister?
We do.
You.
Okay, but I guess what I'm I don't know if you listen to the first part. I was doing a rant about why isn't it explained the way we explain it?
Anywhere? Well, because first, all right. So here's a good question: Why do you think that the powers that be in the state of Illinois and the state of Tennessee, for that matter, tolerate somebody getting out of middle school without understanding how exponents work?
Well, for me to solve all the problems with primary school, I'm saying, how does somebody get out of grad school and not know what inflation does to people?
Well, look, it starts with people who can't make sure change for a $20 bill, but allegedly have a high school diploma.
I think it starts in that you focus on the stuff that is causing you trouble in your life. If somebody's sick in your family, that's your focus, right? Well, if you're sick, it's certainly your focus.
My job as an educator is supposed to be just that, teach you how to think.
I understand that, but I'm trying to find the differences between when this happened before and what it happens now, and I'm using you guys as sounding boards. I'm not pontificating. I don't think I am. At least I'm trying not to. Why doesn't anybody realize what Milton Friedman and everybody realized back then, that inflation is the cruelest tax of all? Because I think, I can't just say there's no reason to think that way. Now, why do I think there's always a reason for everything. And I think the reason why Amazon pays more for the basketball game is because they think they're going to sign up more people to Prime because they have to do it to buy the game. Now, I don't know that.
Well, of course.
So, I mean, that just makes sense. Now, the question is why, when inflation affects just about everybody, I think it goes back to what we've talked about since you've been on the show, for God's sake. The wealth of the country right now, despite what... Matter of fact, I'll read something here from Bobby Kennedy, believe it or not, if I can find it, after break. The reason is there are people who benefit by inflation and people who don't. Now, back in the late 80s, late 70s, 80s, even the late 60s when it all started, there weren't very many people that owned stock. There were some. Everybody, if you work for a company, my uncle had AT&T because he worked for, you know, Western Electric, that kind of crap. My grandfather, he bought stock when he was he worked on the railroad because he thought owning shares of a company were so American, so unique, such a great thing to do, he did it. And there weren't very many people like that. And look what happened to me from listening to him. I'm stuck in this. I'm not stuck. I like it. But what is different this time? Why doesn't anybody give a crap? When I say anybody, look at the people who are getting hurt. I mean, Trump and his gang, they're benefiting tremendously by inflation. Anybody who has fixed assets of any kind, if you own a baseball team, oh, God. I mean, let me go a little further. Anybody who owns stocks and so forth, I would say in the last 6 weeks, if my clients, who, you know, I'm not saying they're all well-to-do, but they have stock here, so they got some dough, are further ahead by what's happened in the market due to the money pouring in the system than they are at the gas pump behind, even though they'll bitch about the gas pump. That's, my clients don't do that, but the extra $10 you paid at the gas pump this week is more than taken care of by the 100 shares of Microsoft you have, or the 100 shares of NVIDIA. You're not even close. So the wealth you see in the country is because of asset ownership. Not just general stuff, you know, cars and houses and stuff that people own, but in this kind of stuff, like stocks, like investment properties, those kinds of things are all up, except if you're downtown Chicago. You more than gain. So more people are in that part of the K than used to be. Otherwise, there's no real voice of the guy who owns no stock, owns no building, and it just is, everything he does every day is costing him more money. And by the way, hasn't got a raise in 2 years. That guy has zero voice at all. I'm convinced that that's what it is.
Well, okay. But here's, you know, So, like I said, there's a Pavlovian.
Well, I mean, I guess what I'm saying is I look at this, what's happening, and I'm appalled, and yet I look at the week my clients have had, and I'm happy about it. So even I'm torn.
Okay, well, why? Okay, so you're perfectly okay with screwing the guy that...
No, absolutely not, but I'm saying...
...cleans your building. Yes,
no,
you are.
Well, no, I'm not. I am absolutely not.
No. You just said you're torn.
I said I'm torn when I talk to a client.
Oh, but you're not torn...
By the way, the stock I bought for you is up 10%. By the way, I'm not going to say I'm a genius because I didn't make it go up 10%, but it's better than going down, and he's happier than if it went down. What can I tell you? I mean, everybody is.
Well, of course he is. What happens when the guy on the street who cleans your building can't afford to buy food for his family this week?
Somehow, this is by the way, this is the most long-winded question I've ever asked. Why aren't we there yet? I think we're getting closer. That's why I'm worried.
Oh, well, we are to a large degree there. By the way, what do you think is driving all of this insane amount of fraud that nobody wants to step on?
Because if you're not cheating, you're not trying right now. If you're not cheating, you're not. If you're not cheating, you're not trying.
What do I do with the money I steal?
Well,
if I'm one of those guys.
You'd spend it on stuff you need.
Oh, I spend it.
Yeah.
Okay. And what does that do to GDP?
Well, all right, but you have to be...
All right, now wait a minute. What's... Chief, now, all right, you've been in business, okay? You worked at Pullman, all right? I've been in business. I ran a company where I had to buy things and then I sell them, right? Hopefully I add some value in the middle, otherwise I don't stay in business very long.
Well, yeah.
Well, I mean, you know, that's how that works, right? All right. So let's take something just very ordinary but very necessary. Sulfuric acid.
I thought you were going to say toilet paper.
Well, we could do toilet paper too. You know, hey, some guy got pissed off and lit their warehouse on fire out in California.
Really?
But let's say sulfuric acid. Okay, so sulfuric acid, for those people who aren't aware, most people know it's in their car battery. It's what makes your car battery work. But it's also a absolutely necessary chemical for a whole bunch of other stuff.
Oh, yeah, without a doubt.
All right, I mean, it is a feed chemical for God and everything almost. I mean, virtually anything plastic, anything... It's everywhere. Okay. I have to take inputs in order to make the sulfuric acid. It's corrosive as hell, so when I ship it after I make it, I have to have containers that are able to resist being destroyed while it's being shipped. They cost money.
You got one hell of a tank car or tank for sure.
Well, you know, so I mean, you know, they do ship it, the stuff shipped by rail and also by truck. Obviously it's a hazardous material, and so, you know, there's additional cost involved there because it's dangerous. If it gets out into the environment, it's bad news. And okay, so all these things are costs. So after I pay all these costs and I sell the stuff, let's say I sell $1 million worth of this material, what do you think I actually got after I pay the costs?
Well, you better have some profit.
Well, so I have so, but the point is, I don't have $1 million.
No.
Okay. Maybe I have $100,000. I have a 10% operating margin. Maybe. Okay. Maybe if I'm really, really good, I could figure out a way to do better than that. But that's
well, if you're buying stuff from other people and you're building a railroad car, 10% is pretty damn good.
Well, and by the way,
if you're Microsoft, if it's not 50, you're not happy, or 60.
Well, by the way, if it's more than 10 in a competitive market, I will attract competitors.
And Microsoft, I meant Apple for the phones. What are they, like 60?
Well, okay, well, guess what? One of the reasons that Apple has the operating margins they do is because of monopolist behavior, okay?
Yeah.
Because of doing things that damn well ought to get you thrown in jail, like offshoring your labor to places that use slaves, you know, and not giving a crap about the environment because it's over in China, this kind of stuff. Which, by the way, if you try to do that in the United States, they do arrest you. So, you know, I mean, hey, let's just go where we have communists.
Hey, we got to do break.
So
hold, anyway. We got to go break, but hold this thought.
All right, I just want to leave you with one thing. If I steal it, my operating margin's 100%.
Well, your time's worth something.
My gross operating margin is 100%.
Well, right. I mean, you just brought one up, the Apple, okay? In China, all the other stuff. There's people who would bitch that their phone is $200 too expensive. There's people... there's people would also bitch that they're using slave labor and all those kinds of things. But I'm saying...
I thought slavery was illegal.
Well, I'm talking about close to slave labor in China.
It is slave labor.
Okay. I said that the first time. And yet, somehow or another, somebody talked them into buying 1,000 shares of Apple at $8. How pissed off are they really?
Well, the whole reason you have laws is because if if the only thing that matters is that, and now now you see why the company has a 50% pre-tax operating margin. It's because they.
By the way, I'm not arguing, my good friend Carl. I'm trying to find a difference between why people aren't pissed off this time as they were last time. And this is just one thought. I mean, it might be a crummy one.
Well, you tell me why every single hospital hasn't been burnt to the ground.
I somehow or another, I don't know why people are putting up with it, but they are. I'm saying someday I will agree with you, my friend.
Because they don't have... Well,
someday, we're talking, we're going to be, where are we, Mel? We're going to be like 11 days in a row straight up here. And every day somebody's going to say, the war is going to end soon, and it's going to go up again tomorrow. Yeah. Someday, somewhere, I think we both know it's going to topple. You know, but I'll tell you what, I wish I was even longer today. Why not? It's going up every day, for God's sake.
Well, it depends on, I guess the bottom line is what is it that, where's the most important component of this? I mean, look, you have Netflix that, they just got, hit for about 10% on their earnings.
Make that like 14.
No,
it's back under 10. It actually came back a little bit.
I was going to say, I'm seeing it down about $10 at pre-market.
Yeah, it's saying at some point...
But this is a company... Chief, this is a company with 10 times sales. I mean, get out of here.
But your government, and my 14 government...
14 times book.
Is going to put as much money into the system they need to salve the wound of this war, just like they did with COVID. At the end of the day... The market's going to be up. Inflation's going to be... Everybody's going to be... Let's put it this way. 80% of the population is going to be minorly pissed off, and 20% of the population is going to be elated. And the 20% that's going to be elated owns the newspapers, owns the TV stations, and guess what? Are fat and laughing at the other 80%.
And every last one of them, whether they're laughing or whether the people that can't put food on the table... all die exactly the same way.
Well, we know that.
Just as easily.
Nobody takes anything with them. But S&P futures up 38, NASDAQ futures up 150. We just march all day long. Be right back, Stocks and Jacks.
Interested in promoting your business to a high-end audience comprised of entrepreneurs, traders, executives, and the everyday business person? Consider advertising on Stocks and Jacks. With a devout listenership covering the Chicago market, along with a vast online presence, advertising on Stocks and Jocks may be just what it takes to put your business over the top. For more information, contact me, Matt Weber, at matt@stocksandjocks.net. That's matt@stocksandjocks.net.
Stocks, Jocks.
Stocks and Jocks.
Stocks and Jocks.
You are out of control.
Right here. Right now. Right here. Right now. Right now.
Hello and welcome back to Stocks and Jacks. I'm Tim Howe. Ricky on the board. S&P futures up 37. NASDAQ futures up 141. We are just relentless, which is, it's good for a lot of people. A lot of them are my clients, so I guess that's a very good thing. Of course, it is my job to worry, so I always have to try and make sure that we don't get too giddy on this and keep protected and so forth. But right now, who needs no stinking protection? I mean, what the hell? Over in Europe, we have the DAX is... up 120.5%. The FTSE is actually down 18.2%. These communist pinkos. CAC around up 38.5%. Well, why would anyone doing that over there? Over in Asia, last night these guys were down. I don't think they're down anymore. But as soon as my computer decides it wants to make a move here, I gotta get Hal in here, or Carl in here, to fix my stuff. Nikkei down 1,000 points, 58,475. Hang Seng down 233, that's 0.9%. Nikkei is down, it's almost 2%. Shanghai down 4. Asia markets fall as fragile Mideast ceasefire tempers sentiment. There you go. Bonds. These guys are up yesterday. We're 4.28 on the 10-year. The Bund is 3.01. You actually had a pretty good move up in interest rates. Coming back down here today a little bit. Oil. Down $5. That's part of the reason for this. 89.66. We had natural gas up 2 cents, 266. RBOB is down to 308. Gold, which has been getting trounced, it's up $31 today, 4,800. Silver up $1.40, 80.16. Foreign exchange, and this is all over the place. They don't talk enough about this. Well, nobody cares, but it's actually the driver of just about everything. Dollar set for second weekly drop. Is the euro is now over 118. It was under 116. 2% moves in the currency is massive. It's massive. And, you know, if you don't do that kind of trading, you don't realize that, but it's huge. A British pound almost 136. Crypto up 552, 75,753 as it stays up there. Ricky, what do you got for us, traffic, weather, sports?
Hey, good morning, Chief. It's currently 7:37 here in Chicago. We're looking at 50 degrees right now with a high of 75 and a low of 47. Warm, cloudy, and dense fog this morning, then some sun. Tonight we'll have a few thunderstorms, some severe, cloudy, and windy with a few showers late. Significant risk for flash flooding, hail, and destructive winds. So watch out for that. Phoenix, Arizona, 64 degrees right now with a high of 87. Sunshine and very warm. Tonight will be clear with a low of 62. Traffic in Chicago is looking a little bit congested, but nothing too crazy. 60 minutes in Mount Kennedy from Monroe's, 29 minutes Edens from Lane Cook, Eisenhower from Wolf, 34 minutes, then Ryan from 95th, 26 minutes, and lastly, inbound Stevenson from 294, 33 minutes. Let's go sports real quick for the MLB. The Sox lose to Rays yesterday, 5-3, and today we got Mets at Cubs at 1:20 p.m., Sox at Athletics at 8:40 p.m., and Blue Jays at Diamondbacks at 8:40 p.m. as well. Lastly, NBA, 8th seed game of the play-ins right now. Today we got Hornets at Magic, 6:30 p.m., and lastly, Warriors at Suns at 9 p.m. Back over to you, Chief.
Carl, I'm not trying to disparage anybody. I just whenever you hear people talk, and I think you do this because you're out and about a lot. When people, and we do the same thing. There's always, what did Tom Selleck say? Whenever somebody over the age of 15 opens their mouth after five words, you know their agenda.
There you go.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's interesting to me. You know, I have this year, it just so happens. Last year we had a lot of stock that people gave us to protect, different kinds, and I won't go through which ones they were, but people can sort of figure them out. They're the big ones. And a few of them went straight down, right? So we had protection on them. So the portfolio, the stock portfolio was down in value. But we made, I wouldn't say all of the money back on puts, but we made a reasonable percentage back on puts and protection. You're never 100% protected. But so we had a lot of cash for everybody in December, for not everybody, for a lot of people, that their stocks did that, and it was more than you would have guessed. So my brother and I are like, everybody wants it invested. What are we going to do with this? And Dan was real bright. He says, you know, everybody says this oil is never going anywhere. It's like $57. Because every time it gets here, people say it's never going up again. It always does. Whenever it gets over 100, people say it's never going down again, and it always does. Why don't we, you know, put some in the, let's not try and pick an individual oil company. Let's put money in the XLE. We'll protect it our normal way so there's limited risk. We'll give it some room on the upside. We didn't give it quite enough. But, well, the XLE, which is the oil piece of the S&P, was 44 at the beginning of the year. Made it to 62, now it's 56. So we're talking 20% return in what, 90 days?
Yeah.
So, you know, we had puts, so we didn't make the whole 20%. But the how many people, even of our clients, that maybe have 1,000 shares of it, you know, they're up $9,000.
Yeah.
And they're gonna bitch because they paid a dollar more at the gas tank. Well, why do you think you're up to $9,000? I mean, duh. I mean, you know, I'm not disparaging anybody. I would never, especially a client. But I think my clients put the two and two together. I don't know if everybody else does.
Well, I don't think most people do. One of the things that I find especially ridiculous about all this, though, is you know, the old saying, past performance is no guarantee of future results, yeah. Right? Of course, that is certainly not what everyone has been trained to expect, right? And the problem with a services-based economy, which we are, and have been for quite some time, is that the way you get there and you become more and more insensitive to the feedback signals that otherwise get sent by doing things like this is precisely that. But you can only get each of those steps that you do once. So, in the 1970s, the answer to the inflationary spike was to force women out of the house, right? Well, okay, so you did that. Now you have two incomes. This is how you could manage to get some frozen concentrated orange juice in containers and still have them in your freezer so your kids had orange juice in the morning. Because we didn't have paper boxes.
We had Tang.
Yeah, okay, that was even worse.
Yep.
But when I was growing up, now... Go ahead and try to find that stuff in the freezer case. Forget about it. It's all in paper cartons, pre-mixed, right?
Yep.
By the way, it's considerably more expensive this way, and everybody just swallowed that. Okay, why? Because you didn't have to buy a pitcher one time, right? I mean, if you think about it, what's the difference? None, except that you don't have to have a pitcher because it comes in a paper carton, and then you throw it out.
It's too much effort.
Well, it takes 30 seconds to mix the stuff up, right? If it's frozen, but that's what I grew up drinking for orange juice, all right? And as I became an adult and as time, I'm like, what the f is this? This stuff's twice as expensive, and it's exactly the same damn thing. Okay, the two quarts is the same thing I get from mixing in the pitcher.
I have not seen anybody have a frozen orange juice tube in 20 years.
You and I both, all right? What do you think? What was Trading Places about, right? Yeah. What were they trading, right? From the kind of the FCOJ. But it's funny, though, that this, this kind of thing becomes normalized. You used to have, you had in the freezer case in the store, all the stuff stacked up in the freezer case, right? Now you have an entire cooler full of 15 different kinds of orange juice. All right, in the grocery store.
Pulp, no pulp.
Pulp, no pulp. This company,
a little bit of cranberry added, a little bit of pineapple added, you name it.
Yeah. 15 different types, all of which are, five times the cost of what the frozen concentrated one was. And yet everyone swallows this with absolutely no pushback of any kind. And they still sell plenty of orange juice.
Don't go into the difference between a cup of coffee at Meijer's and one at Starbucks.
Well, that was going to be the next place I went. Okay, when I ran MCS, we pretty much every other company has a brain in their head. Has a coffee machine in the break room because caffeine is a legal performance enhancing drug.
All
right. I mean, that's one of the best.
And every time they try and do a study proving how bad it is for you, it turns out it's better for you.
Well, and return on investment for that one for the guy that owns the place is pretty good, right?
Yep.
So I mean, not just from a productivity point of view, although that certainly counts, but in addition, it's just kind of one of those things that people expect. Well, I found that believe it or not, community coffee out of a can is actually considerably better than the swill that most people have, the Folgers or the Maxwell House or whatever have you, and it wasn't any more expensive. So I'm like, well, I'll actually drink this stuff. This is pretty good.
I see you being a Starbucks guy.
Well, I'm not a Starbucks guy at all. I think Starbucks is trash. Starbucks is the McDonald's of fast food coffee, and they get their results exactly the same way. It's garbage, but it's repeatable garbage.
I was having a beer one night, and the guy next to me was allegedly a coffee expert. And he said that Starbucks, they differentiate themselves. The, the beans, when they roast them, are actually burned.
Right, they do it on purpose.
Yes, they do it on purpose because it gives it a very distinctive taste.
No, that's not why they do it. Well, no, they do it on purpose. He's right about the first part.
Well, he claims that if you like Starbucks, everything else is going to taste like crap.
No, he's wrong about why they do it. When you roast, I have a roaster in my garage. Okay, I'm a snob.
Right.
The reason they do it is because when you roast coffee, especially if you're going to make espresso with it, for regular coffee, it's harder to tell the difference. But for espresso, it's not. After about 2 weeks, you get no crema on the top of the shot, which is from the carbon dioxide that's in the beans. And that is a very clear, easily discernible by the customer marker that the beans are not fresh. And in fact, they taste like crap after about 2 weeks. Okay. So, but the customer can see it before he pays you.
Yeah.
So that's a problem. So what Starbucks does is they burn them on purpose. See, the issue is this: they don't have roasters in the stores. Think about how many stores they've got. How do you manage the supply chain issue of roasting the coffee wherever your central sites are that you do it? Then you have to get it to the store and you have to consume it within the 2 weeks. And anything that doesn't get consumed by the time it starts losing its crema, you have to throw in the trash.
Well, how does the roasted coffee sit on a supermarket shelf, even if it's not crushed for a while?
It's complete garbage after the 2 weeks.
Okay? And even whole bean.
Yeah. It's garbage because that's just the way it is.
Okay, well, this guy's pointing.
It has a 2 weeks. Chief, the bottom line is that if you actually want decent tasting espresso and good tasting coffee, it has a 2 week shelf life. And that's the end of the conversation.
Really?
The stuff that is, and if you ever have it, you ever get a shot of espresso pulled from somebody that's a roaster in the building, and there are some coffee shops that do, or you find somebody like me that's a snob and has one in his garage. Then you have one of those drinks in a glass, and you'll never go back to drinking any of the other trash ever again.
Okay, well, let's slide back into where the market is here, because
yeah,
I mean, obviously, I you're one of my best sources. You know, I'm very blunt about what my job is for people. It's to protect their stuff, get out of the way on the upside, be there with protection on the downside, and essentially lock in stuff when it goes up. I mean, that's what I do. Nobody else does. And, you know, it's very challenging when things run up, you know, 10, 15, 20% in a couple of weeks, because you're like, gee, the stock's at 380. Can I sell the 400 calls? Well, yeah, 400 looks like a mile away, especially like a week from
now.
And
then it's going to get called away.
Yeah, and all of a sudden it's 425, and you're going, what the hell did I just do?
Right.
But those moves are... They're insane. They're policy driven moves. They're not, especially the companies we're talking about. We're not talking about companies that found oil in their backyard like yesterday. We're talking about companies you kind of know what they're doing. And you know, 1, 2, 3, and 4% moves on a day, unless it's an earnings day, are historically very rare. Yet we're seeing them.
Well, not no more.
And so you know, again, the other job is to worry for people now. And what I've been barking about to Carl and Kevin and everybody else is willing to listen is the inflation is coming, it's there. Okay, but obviously it's not affecting anything here. In fact, it's very positive for the market in the short term, and there's a huge history to that. Weimar, Argentina, you name it. The problem is your currency gets kissed, just like ours is getting kissed in the ass, it's going down. That's a problem. Okay, now, if the inflation gets to a certain point, what happens? I mean, your interest rates should run up, okay, because now nobody's going to want to lend money to people that if they know there's inflation because they want a lot back. Well, the Fed is covering that, or so they think, by essentially buying the bonds, deluding us into the idea that these interest rates aren't going up, or nobody feels. There's a reason why they had to buy $100 billion worth of bonds in 7 weeks. Because guess what, Carl? You got a lot of dough, but you're not going to short $110 billion worth of bonds and fight the Fed. You're not going to do it.
No, I'm not.
No, you're not.
I know what's going to happen.
So the question is there a limit to how much they can do that? Okay, this worry wart me says, after the COVID experience, I'm not sure there is a limit of that. They're willing to go anywhere. So, okay, I can't count on the Fed having cooler heads, because they don't. And I don't understand why Trump wants to fire the guy. The guy's done exactly what he's asked the entire time he's been there. So I have no idea what that.
Because he wants even more.
I don't know how you get any more.
It's the same mentality that's driving this garbage with AI. Okay, I don't know if you saw this thing that just popped up this morning.
Okay, let me get to my question real quick, though.
All right.
Now the next question is, where are we getting this dough from? We're not taxing it. We're not. We are borrowing it. The Fed's buying some. The rest we're borrowing.
Right.
Roughly 50% from people here. The other 50% from people overseas, which is like a boatload. Now, look at the policies of the world. We're getting our biggest contributors, for lack of a better term, Japan, $1.2 trillion. United Kingdom, $900 billion. China, $700 billion. Belgium, yep. $454 billion. Canada is probably doing fine with the oil prices up this much, $446 billion. I'm not worried about them, although they don't like us. Now you're down to Ireland, which is going into a full-fledged revolution right about now, and they're giving us $350.
Well, that might have something to do with $10 a gallon diesel.
Well, I'm saying, now all of a sudden, with our policies, we've now taken it to the next step. We're aggravating and hurting the piss out of the people that we're counting on to finance us. Now, is that the next thing I should worry about? That if China shows up with six tankers and said, we're going through the... It's one thing to tell the world, Iran, those bastards, have straight closed, you can't come through here. It's quite another for us to say, we say you can't come through here. Now, if China shows up with six tankers, by the way, I let a Chinese tanker through the other day. Are we going to fire on things, those things, and tell them no?
Well, that was the question that I had. By the way, the Chinese are perfectly capable of sticking a detachment of their Marines on that boat.
Well, yeah, have we thought any of this through? Are we going to stop? Well, what if Britain says, hey, we need some of this oil? We're not going to Iran to get it. We're going to Saudi to get it. No, you can't come through here.
Yeah, you know, one of the things that really, that I find especially galling is Starner, has been out there screaming about, there being this huge problem with their prices there. And, of course, Ireland's getting hit by the same basic thing.
Yeah. Right?
And the reality of it is that it is precisely the policies of the British government. I mean, Britain has a crap ton of oil offshore. All right. Why do they have their own benchmark for crude, for Christ's sakes? That's why. And yet, why aren't they using it? Well, because it's not green.
I think they probably are using some. But the point is, we are not set up for, everybody thinks.
No, you can't just run a random barrel of crude. It doesn't work
all right,
like that.
We've got a guy, somehow is in the White House. We got a guy that comes out one day and says, don't worry, we are energy independent here. We don't need anybody else's oil, which technically is probably true. We produce 21 and we use about 21. Now, the differentiation is and where the locality is, we actually do export some and import some. Okay, forgetting that, just look at the numbers. We're 21 and 21. In the next utterance out of his mouth, come and buy our oil here.
Oh, well, and
I'm sitting
there
going, wait a minute. Now, if we sell 4 billion a day or 4 million a day, where does that leave us?
The price.
Yeah, right. Where does that leave us? Okay.
Well, where it leaves his friends
yeah.
is with a whole shitload of money. And where it leaves you is with a big hole in your wallet.
Well, yeah. And, it's... It's one of the most trite sayings ever from the trading floor, and I use it way to hell more than I should. Whenever, somebody like Trump, and there's a lot of people like Trump, come out and say, we are going to do this. I remember when everybody did that in the trading floor, somebody would say, who's we? You got a mouse
who's
in your pocket?
Yeah.
You got a mouse in your pocket? And who's we? His we is not you. I don't know how MAGA people at this point still believe that the we is them.
Well,
I'm talking the same thing about Biden. The we wasn't me either.
The playbook for all the way back to when the various trade unions went too far and the response was, oh, well, we'll pass NAFTA, right? And oh, by the way this was sold to the American public and put through was that those Mexicans down there that are making $2 an hour, making, you know, right now, we're going to put the car alternator plant down there, all right, making $2 an hour. But they won't be making $2 an hour for very long. They'll be making 25, like the UAW guy up here. Okay. Now, of course, nowadays it's more than that. But, you know, at the time it was, right? They'll be making 25. Therefore, they'll be able to buy the cars. This is going to wildly expand the market. And the economy of scale means this, that ultimately, your car's cheaper and everyone wins. Well, that's not what happened, is it?
It wasn't, and you know, it's funny you should bring that up, because let's talk about it on Tuesday, because...
Because here's the thing. What actually happened was the guy makes, instead of making, you know, two, he makes three. Yeah, okay, he makes a little more. However, Ford pocketed the $18.
But they never gave it...
Didn't give it back to you.
They also didn't really give it to the shareholders. It went internally. But there's a huge... This a lot of this was... All this crap, the I won't say crap, all this movement started back in the mid-70s. In academia. And the foolishness, and my revered professor, Milton Friedman, was on the leading end of this. But the mistake they made... is he always thought, and those around him, and at the time, I don't know, you could argue with him all that much, but now, obviously, you can, they thought that economic freedom would eventually trump political oppression.
And never does.
Or monopolistic oppression, or, you know, other kinds of oppression, religious, or whatever you name.
Right, no, and I got it.
Because you know where they looked? They were foolish enough, and I'll say that to Milty if I ever meet him in the past life. They were foolish enough to only look at our history, ours and Britain's. If you look at our history, it took centuries, but the British finally revolted against this. They revolted against that. They ended up having labor agreements. We did the same thing here. Everybody forgets the part about we almost didn't get a labor agreement at Pullman when George Pullman hired Pinkertons with rifles to shoot people. We almost didn't get that here, but the economics were such that it kind of trumped everything because they needed labor. Labor was the shortage.
Right.
So the idea was that somehow we're going to make this happen in Mexico, even though we know the government's corrupt, we know Ford's corrupt, and we know the gangbangers are corrupt. That somehow they will, over a period of a decade, even if it costs a few lives and those kinds of things, they will somehow get to the same place we are. Or in China, that the Xi's government is not going to be able to withstand a growing independent economy. But do you know what the fact is? They have.
Well,
right?
Here's all right. So, if you want to know how crazy this is and why I'm I do not know where this exponential, you know, blow off. I don't know when it folds back. It feels an awful lot like 1999 to me, in the fall of 1999 specifically.
Yeah.
Okay. But this just popped up.
But, Carl, don't forget, the Fed did pull back after a while, Y2K.
I understand that. Okay. But the Fed's actions right after Y2K are why we got a housing bubble. And it only went on for a couple of years, and then they stopped. Now we've been doing it since 2008, and it hasn't stopped.
The housing bubble is twice as bad as it was in 2007.
The problem is it's everywhere,
and
it's been going on for so long that people think it will never end. And the people at the Fed, after the 2000 crash, realized that if they continued to do this, they were going to have a huge problem. Well, they ended up with one anyway, all right, and it blew up in everyone's face. Now we've been doing it. We literally have people in the market and in industry today that have never worked on a productive basis. I'm not talking about, you know, being a wage slave when you first get started, because everyone does. 15 years. I mean, that for a lot of people, that's their entire professional life at this point, right? We've been doing this crap. Elon Musk yesterday puts this out. Universal high income via checks issued by the federal government is the best way to deal with unemployment caused by AI. AI and robotics will produce goods and services far in excess of the increase in the money supply, so it will not be inflation.
It's out of his mind. Well, if he's right, he's okay.
No, he's not.
I mean,
if
it turns out that production is up 5%, we could absorb 5% increase in the money supply. But I don't think we're going to have production going up that much.
Okay, Chief. If you high income, you're talking about all the people that make 150, 200 grand right now. Okay, all of these companies literally have forced their employees to train the computer that then takes the job. It's exactly what Disney did to all of their IT people when they shipped them all off to India.
Yeah.
And now it's happening again in the same place. The difference is that, and this is where Elon is absolutely wrong. On a bounded data set, computer processing is faster than a human. There's no question about that. Computers are, they're just faster. Fine. On a bounded data set, this is fine. On an unbounded data set, which is what he's talking about with regards to coding and so-called general artificial intelligence, the error compounding, and this is the same problem that exists with quantum computers and nobody's actually fixed it, the error bounding expands exponentially with the complexity of the task. And when the billing model, the way you make money, is by keeping people using it, you're never going to get the machine to tell you, I don't know.
Yep.
It's not that it doesn't. It's that if it does that, you stop putting coins in the machine.
Well, I mean, you're talking about somebody, and there's a few similar people around. There's way too many of these guys. I look in the mirror and I see, gee, there's some gray hair there. This used to look better. I'm sure when he looks in the mirror, he sees angels around him and halo on him and everything else. It's a different mindset.
You cannot get away from the law, the mathematical laws of exponents.
Yes, you can if you're a deity.
Okay, well, guess what? There are no actual deities, okay? I mean, if there's one up there in the sky somewhere, he's the only one that's figured this out. And, I've gone through this in other contexts, too, people talking about, becoming an interstellar species and things like this. If we ever approach this and somebody else has done it first, given our record, just in Iran, but not just in Iran, everywhere else, given our record, we're going to get Alderaan.
Well, you know what the the Pope referred it to? It's a delusion of omnipotence.
Yeah. Well, guess what? You're the realities of life have this way of smacking you upside the head.
Some people don't pay any attention to that. They pay no attention to that.
I'm well aware of that. But this guy is, and believe me, there are plenty of people right now out there in the economic world, in the market world, that believe this tripe that Elon piped out with.
Yeah.
All right. About, well, this isn't actually a problem. This isn't going to produce an economic dislocation. I'll tell you what. You tell me what happens to the guy who was making 200 grand a year at Google, all right, writing code, all right? He's built a lifestyle around this, and I've warned people about this with regards to retirement.
The bottom line is, if he put all his stock in Google and Google makes $9 zillion, he's do just as well with it by his dividends, which they'll never pay him.
Probably not, okay? But the problem is, he got laid off today. He's got a $5,000 a month nut.
I'll read this thing from Robert Kennedy on Monday, but as my buddy Doc, not Dr. J, we'd see somebody who, all of a sudden he inherits all his dough, gets maybe some stock in a company that goes to the moon, and the guy's got the sports car and everything, and Doc would say to me, that's all okay. The bad part is he thinks he deserves it. He goes, if he didn't, it'd be okay, but he thinks he deserves it.
Right. And the problem is that when now this guy that just got laid off that had this job, he's got 6 months. He can't replace his income because nobody's hiring at that price. Okay. He's got 6 months and he's bankrupt and in the street.
Oh, yeah. Well, there's I mean, I guess there's a lot of different kinds of people in the world. There's two. If you and I win the lottery, we're going to say, man, we're the luckiest people that ever walked. There are people that say God finally figured it out, right?
Well, I think we've got, you know, I don't know precisely where it comes, but I'll tell you what, the vibes I get from people right now on the street among my friends, I just shake my head. I don't even bother having a conversation.
Well, do you think I need the last question? Do you think I need to be, why am I worried about the foreign stuff? Because those seem to be the area that's starting to fray a little bit, and we're way dependent on them.
No, it's here. Because the displacement that's happening to people, and that displacement's real in the higher end of the workforce, it's stupid on the parts of the firms that are doing it.
But
okay,
look how
going to blow up in their face. But right. For the time, but what it does, the impact on people is real, and the impact on purchasing power is real, and everyone's keeping the wheels spinning by running up their credit cards right
well,
now.
Well, okay, but again, well, let's kick this around on Tuesday because. How far does it have to go? Because you're painting the same picture as the 1920s.
I know I am.
But it got so bad before the thing actually crashed. We don't want that. A Model A cost $400. A Duesenberg cost what? $11,000.
Chief, what are you going to do? How are you going to stop it?
I don't know.
You're not until the dislocation comes, because nobody is going to do a damn thing about it. And when the dislocation comes, with given the differences today, okay, you know, you just had the defense secretary screaming, I think it was him, screaming, oh, Russia's going to put a nuke in space and, you know, and take out all these low Earth satellites and it'll screw everything.
No, wait a minute, everybody. Russia's got to be behind Cuba. They're next.
Well, yeah, probably right. So I mean, anybody that thinks that this kind of stuff is. Oh my God!
What was this guy like as a kid? As you walk to school and you see some kid on the other side of the street that gave you a dirty look, you think he might want to come after you, so you get to burn his house down that night?
I have no idea. I have absolutely no idea.
I mean, where do we get these people?
I'm just kind of looking at this, going, all right, you know, here we are, but for how long?
Yeah, I know.
The problem with it, Chief, as you know, is that when it starts, and I've talked to a couple of friends of mine, I ought to be all in here, you know, especially with, you know, the last week or so. And I said, look, are you going to be able to sleep at night if you wake up in the morning and you're down 10-15%?
Well, you're crazy. Well, last comment, because we're over, but it's reached the point now, if somebody were to say, I think the stock's going from 400 to 480 by the end of the year. I need to buy some. I go, okay, wait a minute. You're probably right. I mean, you know the stock better than I do. How about if I show you a way where we do a call spread that I can get you to the same place for, you know, one-tenth the risk? And just buy it. Okay.
All right.
You know, I mean, it's not like I didn't show you another way. I mean, I could get you there with less risk, you know. You might have, might cost you a little bit of insurance in there, but why would I do that?
It's not going down.
I think it's going up. Why would anybody think it's going down? You know, it's just. Anyway, buddy, have a good weekend. Supposed to get more and more rain tonight, even though everything's already flooding. We don't need that, but today's nice.
You do. Come on, you need more of it.
You know, we should. I'll tell you what. I don't really want to give water to the Southwest. They can have tonight's rain.
Well, we
got enough. SP Futures up 66. Nasdaq Futures up 290. I'm going to say, 104.50 today? Why don't we come out and say the war is almost over for like the 1,000th time? That's always good for a couple hundred points. Back on Monday.
Absolutely.
Back on Monday, Stocks and Jacks.
That's all, folks.